Okay, we are just coming up on the Magic Witching Hour. You can go ahead and stop the share. And so, yes, again, welcome everybody to the May meeting of the AutoPC User Group. A little bit different tonight, rather than a regular presentation. We are going to have our computer Ask the Geeks session. So we have people lined up for that. I'll let Alan introduce that. But just to reiterate that if you want to join, if you are a guest, by all means. And Keith, I'm going to mute you too. So we are going to, if you want to join, you can come to the homepage and just click on the join or renew button at the top of the page. And it's just $20 a year if you want to join. But otherwise, you can continue to join any of our meetings as a guest if you so desire. And in order to kick off tonight's meeting, I'm going to mute all, but as we do on Q&A, everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves, so please feel free to do so if you have a question or a comment, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And I'd like to kick it over to Alan to introduce us to tonight's program.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So the program tonight, I actually stole from another computer club. I stole the idea anyway. And they actually called it Stump the Geeks, and the idea was to, I guess, to find questions that the panel couldn't answer. But we're Canadian, so we're much much more polite, and we're just going to ask the geeks questions. So what we're looking for tonight, as it says here, your questions, they're best guesses. We're looking for your questions. So there are two ways that you can ask your question, basically. You can type your question into the chat window, and I'll have that in just a second. Or you can raise your electronic hand, and what that does is it brings you to the top of the list, and we can see that you want to ask a question, and we will invite you to do so. So if you look around probably the bottom of your Zoom window, you should find a bunch of icons. And the one I circled here is the chat window. So if you click on that icon, it opens up this pop-up window here. And you'll see down at the bottom there in the blue, it says type your question here. So that's where you will actually type your question. And then when you've typed it, you can hit enter, or you can press this little blue send button right here, and that will enter the question into the chat window. And Chris and I will be monitoring the chat window as we go along, and we'll take the questions in order as they're received. The other thing you can do, if you move along the window, next to the chat icon is a button that says React. And you'll see there's a whole bunch of reactions that you can use. The one we're interested in is the one that says Raise Hand. So if you click on that one, then what happens is this little hand shows up in your thumbnail, and your thumbnail jumps to the top of the queue. So we can see who is actually asking the question. So type your question into the chat window or raise your hand, and we'll invite you to ask your question.
And now, just before we move on, Alan, just a nuance, because, of course, Zoom doesn't do things consistently. You may actually have the raise hand icon show up in the main bar of icons rather than it being under the React. So if you click on React and you don't see raise hand, just look in the main bar, and you should see it there.
Okay. So that's not how mine works, but never mind. Yeah, there's lots of different Zoom versions have different capabilities, that's true. Okay, so before we get going, let's actually meet the panel, meet the geeks here. So in no particular order, i.e. alphabetically, I'm Alan German. I've been around computers for a long time, but I must say I've never actually taken a course in any kind of computing. I'm completely self-taught, but I've been using computers since mid to late 1960s, and I started off on mainframe, and I used mainframes, and then when IBM PCs came along, I switched to those, and then more recently, of course, I've been using smartphones and tablets, and I've worked with computers. I've used them as tools in my work. I've been a lecturer at a technical college, and a vehicle safety researcher was my main occupation. I've actually been a member of the club since 1993 when I moved to Ottawa. And as everybody knows, I think my main computing interest is Linux. I'm also a huge fan of open source and free software. And I also really like computer programming of all kinds of stripes. So that's me. Moving along in alphabetical order is Chris. Chris came along in 1981 with his first real computer, as he says, which was a Luggable, one of the Osborne Luggable computers. Only 24 pounds to carry around at the time, no problem. Chris is an IT professional. He's worked in user and server support for Natural Resources Canada when he was working. He's been a busy little boy outside of work. He was a Microsoft MVP 15 times and received a couple of awards there. Written hundreds of articles, I'm sure. Everybody will have seen Chris's articles in the club's newsletter. But he's also written for Glasswire and PC Magazine. And he's also been a review board member for the Sandouche security newsletter. You also know Chris has given lots of presentations, both for the club and especially for the library, and most recently, this afternoon included, for the Association of PC User Groups, an international, largely American, Canadian, Australian association, and for various other clubs associated with APCUG and Ottawa Community Associations. Chris has been involved with the club for more than 40 years, and he's been an executive member for 40 of them. And he says his main computer interests, as you probably know, are Windows and security. So if you have questions like that, I'm sure Chris will have some answers for you. Next up we have Harvey. Harvey's another IT professional, certified, A-plus certified. And his various certifications there come from the Computing Technology Industry Association, CompTIA, and from the Canadian Information Processing Society, CIPS. Harvey, I guess he must still be working for his living, runs a company called PC Innovation Computer Services in the city here, and helps businesses and other clients with all kinds of computer-related issues, Windows, hardware, internet, email, accounting, all that kind of stuff. So I think Harvey has a pretty broad background in both hardware and software, so again, should be able to answer lots of questions. Steve is a gamer. He came by that honestly. You can see his first gaming experience was with Pong back in 1975, and then chess computer in 77. He had a lot of experience in personal computers. Some of the early ones there: Sinclair, Apple, Commodore, etc. And he says that none of these lasted much very long until he modified them. So he's also a computer modder. He's been involved in a couple of computer clubs, Toronto and Mississauga there, both on the board and a webmaster for Toronto. And did a lot of work in CAD and designing, I believe, sound studios for things like CBC. And now he builds systems, acts as a consultant, and a gaming graphics designer. So, and you recognize Steve as chipping in all the time with comments on the various things we're talking about. So again, a broad knowledge and expertise there. And then our final geek on the panel is Tom Trottier. Tom comes by his IT experience, honestly. You notice there he worked, first programming experience was at York University and Ryerson with time sharing APL. Now, if anybody knows a programming language, APL, you'll know that that is not a programming language to be taken lightly. The standing joke is that if you have to edit the program, you throw it away and write a new one, because it's all symbolic and usually pretty hard to understand what you actually wrote in the first place. The second bullet is kind of interesting. I think one of the questions tonight should be, what happens when you go hitchhiking with a microcomputer in the mid-70s? Well, you notice that Tom is a true professional. He has an actual BA degree in computer science from York. Again, lots of experience with microcomputers, MCM, Apple, and Trash 80s, computer store, I forget. Oh, Radio Shack. That's the Radio Shack computer. And then his first PC was a clone when IBM's first came out there in the early 80s. His main interests are in data and system modeling, programming again, simulations, and he's interested in AI networking and virtual machines. So that's the panel. I did a rough estimate, and I think between us we've got more than 250 years of experience with various kinds of computers. So let's get to the questions, as it says right here. Hands up, and who wants to go first? Anything in the chat right now?
Okay, we actually have a question in the chat right now. So from Natalie, still using Win 10 with ESU, the extended security updates, Win 10 Home on PC, Win 10 Pro on laptop. When I upgrade to Windows 11, is there a difference between upgrading from the Home or Pro version? Is there anything I need to be aware of before I upgrade to either? If I understand the question correctly, Home will upgrade to Windows 11 Home. The Pro will upgrade to Windows 11 Pro. So it keeps the version as you go. Things you need to be aware of before upgrading, make sure you can back up if something goes south in the middle of it all, and that usually means an image backup. So I would do a fresh image backup just before you do the upgrade, and make sure you test your recovery media. As Alan pointed out in a recent article, you want to make sure that you can actually boot from that recovery media and you can access your backup files while booted from that recovery media. Then you know that no matter what goes wrong, or if anything goes wrong, that you're able to back up to the position you were at before you started it. Other than that, there's nothing particular I would recommend being aware of before you upgrade. How about the other geeks? Anything you recommend people do before they do an upgrade to from Windows 10 to Windows 11?
The only thing I'd worry about is that Windows 11 is 64-bit only. Oh, so true. If one of your computers is 32-bit, you cannot upgrade.
And you have to make sure that it's got secure boot, too.
Yeah, make sure you run the PC health check program.
Yeah, that's right. The PC health check should be on your Windows 10 computer. So if you just hit the start button and type in PC health check, it should pop up. And if you run that, it should do all of the checks to make sure that it is compatible with Windows 11. Now, I know of one computer, which I passed on to Linda, and she tried to do the upgrade. It was PC health check said it was fine, and it did not successfully upgrade to Windows 11. And then later on, we were on the Acer. It was an Acer computer. And we went onto the website, and it specifically stated that it was not compatible with Windows 11. So why there was that mismatch, I don't know. But I think it's pretty rare. In most cases, if you do the PC health check and it tells you that you can upgrade to Windows 11, it should be successfully upgradable.
Did it say what didn't meet the standards? Like, was it the CPU?
No, it wasn't the CPU. It was something in the BIOS. And there were some people on the forums that alluded to a newer version of the BIOS that was available that supposedly allowed it to work. And then there was other things I read that said, yeah, it might allow it to do the upgrade, but it was unstable afterwards anyways. So I tried writing to Acer and never got a reply from them.
So the Atlas OS that someone brought up earlier allows you to install Windows 11 without a Microsoft account and on machines that otherwise would not be able to install it. So you, if your Windows 11 install craps out, you could try the Atlas OS and change some of the settings.
There is a presentation that I did last year. You can look that up for the Windows 10 to 11, where you can bypass some of those items. Specifically, a lot of computers fail when they look at the CPU. It has to be at least the 8th generation, but perfect computers work well that are not up to that level.
Harvey, did you ever notice on any of those computers that you forced the upgrade that performance sucked or something like that, that there was something that it was not optimal performance after you got to 11?
No, I've not run into any of those difficulties. Okay. Heather say most of the issues are where they don't accept the CPU as a compatible item, but I've never encountered any issues with that.
Yeah, good to know.
And the other thing is if you're running Windows, you have a Microsoft account, but you can actually use the Windows update, backup, whatever they call it, to transfer your system settings over when you upgrade from 10 to 11. It'll only do just the Microsoft UWP stuff, though. It won't do all your other standalone programs, so it's not really a tremendous advantage doing it that way either.
Especially considering how easy it is to reinstall Windows Store apps anyways.
And the Store apps are never as good as the standalone versions anyway.
I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, I would.
What I was going to say, Steve, what you really want to focus on is the in-place upgrade, moving from 10 to 11.
That's right. That's what I've been. What I was going to do is to take the ISO for the upgrade from 10 to 11 and rewrite the ISO to remove all the bloatware stuff and rewrite the system settings the way I want them.
You may as well try that afterwards. It might be simpler for you.
Okay, well, I actually did have a number of questions. I'm going to move on to one right now because it's a bit complicated, so I made a slide of it. And here's a question. What's the best practice for prolonging your computer's life? Should you never turn it off and let the screen go blank? Should you have the computer hibernate or go to sleep after a certain period of time? Or when you finish the session, should you just turn it off and then turn it back on when you need to? So who wants to go first? Harvey wants to go first.
I just wanted to make a comment about all of those lines. Alan, I'm going to be sending in a presentation for next week's Q&A. I have a share. And essentially, it talks to many of these things. It's going to be doing an automatic startup and shutdown, and it might address a number of those items. Specifically, I don't know if this person's question is about a laptop or a desktop, but in the case of a laptop, for example, saving your battery would and force you to use Hibernate as the best choice. You know, if you hibernate at 11 o'clock at night and maybe the next morning at 9 o'clock it starts, then you're going to save all that battery. Uses battery.
Yeah, that's right.
Hibernate is not good if you have an SSD, because every time you hibernate, it wipes out the contents of memory, at least used memory, to your SSD, and that's usually several gigabytes. And you may use up your SSD's rights by doing that.
Tom's looking at part two.
Tom, I wanted to make a comment about what you said. That's true what you just said. Now, in this presentation you'll see next week, this person's laptop has 32 gigs of memory. So, of course, the Hibernate file is going to want to create itself at 32 gigs, which is a heck of a lot of space on an SSD. You can adjust that and bring it down to the minimal. Now, you're going to see the routines that I've built in to start up the system. It really is not an official Hibernate scenario. It's only used to generate the wake timer, so you'll see it next week.
Well, I'll say what I do, which is to turn off my computer when I'm done with it. If you want to save energy, then you should basically turn off your computer in the summertime when you use air conditioning, but you can leave it on in the winter so that it keeps warming up your house.
Another thing about turning off your computer to consider is whether you do nightly backups or something like that. Like now, mine admittedly it's not a laptop. I'm talking about my desktop computer, but it does backup at 1 o'clock in the morning. So you know, I could put it to sleep because for sure my backup program can wake it up from sleep. But I just leave it powered on. If it was a laptop computer, I'd be a little bit leery about leaving it on all the time because, yeah, it has that impact on your battery, and you don't want to leave it plugged in all the time because that's not good for a battery either. But for a desktop computer, if you have automated backups going on in the middle of the night, that might preclude you making the choice of turning off your computer or having it go into Hibernate mode.
Well, with mine, I have so many things running on it. It's on 24/7. And the battery that's in the laptop is essentially a backup UPS. I've got it all plugged into a UPS as well, but if that goes, then it's got one in the laptop anyway. And I have the screen display turn off, and that's about it.
That was actually my question, and it's a desktop, and my habit has been to let it run 24/7, and some of my computers have been running for 5 years straight, and I've never really shut them off unless the power went off. But that's why I was asking opinions if that's a good practice or not.
Well, I
think,
yeah.
Well, I don't think it's bad for the computer.
The reason for leaving it on is that you have less thermal expansion and contraction, so you're less likely to break traces on the circuit board eventually. So that's the reason to leave it on, is to keep it mostly at the same temperature. If you turn it off and on, then it goes back down to room temperature and then back up to 30, 40 degrees or more, depending on where in the computer you're looking.
Yeah, if you monitor the thermals for the computer, then you don't have to worry too much about it.
Well, in this computer, well, one of them, it's water-cooled, so I'm assuming it maintains a fairly consistent CPU temperature over time. The rest of it would be air-cooled, I guess. So.
What about solid-state versus hard drive? If the hard drive's on 24/7, does the bearing wear out eventually, whereas solid state wouldn't?
No, the solid state's going to run out long before the hard drive does. Hard drives will last a lot longer.
I've had hard drives in my NAS that have lasted 10 years.
Yeah, I got some older than that, or did, okay. Anyway.
Yeah, I have one about 20 years before.
You'd be hard pressed to get an SSD that'll last that long. They were to begin with, the single layer cell one, the SLC. Those lasted for something like 10,000 writes, but now they've got the quad level ones, and what it means is that there's one bit per cell in the SLC. In the quad one, there's 4 bits per cell. So every time it wants to write one bit to a cell, it's writing in that one, and it can write to the same cell 4 times that, which means that it's an exponential decrease in the number of times it can be written to. Writing isn't as detrimental as writing to it. It has to go through the membrane material every time it writes something to the cell. When it reads from it, it doesn't deteriorate it quite as much. So you're okay if you're reading from it, but writing to it, I think it was like something like 10,000 writes with the single layer, and then you divide that by 10 all the way till you get to the quad level ones, and you get about 100 writes to it, and then it's dead.
Well, yeah, the way that SSDs, and for that matter, hard disk work these days, is that they allow a certain error rate, but then they have extra bits that they use to correct that, almost like a RAID system. So they also move it around the edge.
Yeah, they also move it around a lot more on an SSD than an 8. With a hard disk, the bits stay put. But with an SSD, they're all over the place, which is why you don't have to worry about defragging the thing.
The reason you don't have to defrag is that it's very quick to move from file to file in an SSD, while in a hard disk it takes milliseconds, and on an SSD it takes nanoseconds.
Yeah.
Timothy asks, doesn't the hard drive stop running after a time of non-use? I guess more than anything else, that's in the power settings. You can definitely turn off the hard drive after a period of inactivity. But if a Windows computer is running, I don't know when it doesn't write to the hard drive, quite frankly, or storage. It is writing a lot to storage, so I don't think you would ever actually have a point in time where it could stop spinning.
There's another question that says water cooling versus air cooling. And really, you only need water cooling if you're using it as a big workstation that is doing all kinds of calculations. Or you're a gamer and you want an extra 1 or 2 FPS. It's also more complicated, but it works really well in keeping things cool.
Or you can go to nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen works well, too.
Until it runs out.
Okay, there was another question along the same lines. This is to do with logging on to various websites, things like Firefox, things like Facebook and YouTube, and the username and passwords just go away every now and again. And it seems as though once it's been restored, it works for a few days and then they drop off again. And all this has started happening a month ago with Firefox. And a secondary effect is that bookmarks suddenly shut down as well. They're all there, but they're grayed out. So the user has to go into the settings and bring them back, and then they work again for a time. What would cause this disappearance of login credentials and bookmarks? Anybody? Yes, go on, Avi.
It could possibly be that she's clearing the cookies. If you clear out the cookies, you're going to lose, let's just say, something like your user account number that you want to use when you're logging in.
Right.
Well, the bookmarks are stored in the profiles.
No, no, we're not talking bookmarks. We're talking on the previous slide.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that sounds like that makes sense, that if it's cookies, and a lot of people, because they thought cookies were evil, you know, decided to have Firefox clear them out on exit or things like that. Not a good idea.
Cookies are what's used. I mean, they have all kinds of other uses, but they are the things that are used when you want to log in again, and you logged in previously, and it saves. It lets you log in with a password set automatically. I don't know. I'd be worried about the hard disk, and I'd run some tests on that. It's hard to say what the corruption or the loss is. I don't have any special reason for losing bookmarks.
Yeah, I've never heard of it myself.
One of the ways to check on that, Tom, might be to use a different browser.
At least then things might change, and then it'd be good for a little while. It might. I use about 5 or 6 browsers for different things, and I've never had this situation happen with any of them. So I can only think that it's a hardware problem, but either that or it's some corruption somewhere in the OS.
Yeah, as Chris was mentioning, yeah. You know, sometimes when people close the browser, they have the setting to clear out their history and all the rest of it. You know, you may be losing that information doing that. So check your settings. Make sure you're not clearing out cookies or some other aspect of the particular bookmark, let's say.
Okay, all right. Going back to the chat then, there's a really interesting question. Computers and how they're used has changed quite a lot in the last 60 years. Okay, geeks, what do you foresee coming in the years to come?
Selma.
What was that?
Selma stands for Self-Encapsulated Limitless Memory Archive. It's a computer about the size of a credit card, and it has a holographic AI-generated image that you can talk to. So it's a lot like AI on the computer, except that it's all in this little credit card thing. And they had it on a TV show called Time Tracks back in the 1990s with an actor called Dale Midkiff was his name.
I'll refrain from me giving any opinion about what will happen in the future. I recall back when I was working at NRCan in about 1991 or so when the World Wide Web was brand new, the Unix guru came over to show it to me, and he was all excited, and he said, you know, look at this. It's so amazing and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And I watched him use it for a little while, and I said, well, it looks kind of interesting, but it's not going to change my life or anything. So I think that everybody can ignore anything that I say about the future of computing.
And that was the Internet, right? World Wide Web?
Well, back in the 70s, I imagine that the ideal computer would be like very flat, like a piece of paper that I could fold up and put in my pocket. But then when I took it out, I could type on the thing and essentially kind of like a really, really thin cell phone with a large display. And that's what I thought that the thing should be. As for now, I think what's going to change is that I don't see a phone maybe getting smaller and thinner and wider and taller and kind of like that. But I see the main change being AI, because AI is really taking over the search for information or how-tos. And I see there being less people contributing to how to do things in YouTube. So I think it's going to be kind of more of a lack of motivation, because people will be talking with the AI and asking the AI things rather than creating blogs or creating YouTube videos or podcasts. And And so I think it's just going to be more machine in the future.
Does anybody remember a show called Babylon 5? In that, they had these little pieces of glass that looked sort of like an oversized diamond. And they were able to use that like a hard drive to store data on it. And I actually did a bit of research on it. And they can actually store things on glass that'll last for 100 years or more.
I remember Babylon 5.
Yeah.
And it was also Teledon. That was created in about 1977-78.
In France?
No, in here in Ottawa.
Oh, yeah. The first one was in France. But, yeah, we had it here, and I recall the building on Richmond Road. Now that it's now a Rogers building.
Yeah, but there used to be a couple of areas in Ottawa where they had a terminal. And this was pre-internet time.
What do my fellow geeks think about the trend either towards or away from local processing versus, you know, things being done in the cloud? I know that Microsoft has, you know, over the years has had a number of stabs at trying to make it that applications would run in the cloud, and then Windows would run in the cloud, and you would just end up with a thin client that does basically nothing except deliver keystrokes one way and mouse movements one way and the screen contents the other way. But, you know, they were never really all that successful at, you know, having that really come to fruition. But with the advent of AI, you know, it seems like although there are some moves to do local AI processing and having AI-capable chips and things like that, but still, the bulk of the work seems to be done on the back end. And so you're just a dumb client at the end sending the query off to the cloud to have the processing done there. What do people think? Is that going to trend continue in that we'll see more and more where it's processing in the cloud and just a dumb terminal? Or are we going to still see lots of local processing?
Well, the reason companies move to the cloud is that they have automatic backup and they can have multiple sites pretty easily. And it's that's why a lot of companies move to the cloud. They wouldn't have to have their own servers and do other things. So it's simpler for them. As for ordinary people, yeah, everything is in the cloud. Facebook's in the cloud. All the apps that people are using are in the cloud. But these days, with AI, I'm getting an Apple M1 with 64 gig of memory, and I expect to run a variety of different AIs locally. And so long as you have a lot of GPU accessible RAM, it'll become cheaper and cheaper. I mean, this old M1 is like about $2,000 used, originally something like $5,000. But I see more and more of those coming and deliberately being made. Right now, the prices are humongous because of the big players buying all kinds of GPUs or neural processing units and putting them in big farms. But it's going to become cheap enough for the average geek to have at home. Even though most people will just access things through, they could just do it through a terminal rather than even a local PC, but they will still keep using the cloud.
I was just going to say, Chris, you're having Windows machines, so to speak, in the cloud. I mean, that does exist right now. I know of one company. The company is the City of Ottawa. And I think they have in excess of 40,000 seats that they have to manage. And having the systems or having Windows in the cloud simplifies all the configuration. And, of course, they're very heavy on using, what do you call that, Steve? GPMSC. What's that group policy? So they're very heavy on group policy to configure and manage and safeguard all of their seats. So, I mean, he's told me that, you know, in the years to come, we probably won't have computers anymore. AI is a good thing to look at, but I'm sure we're going to have a different device that we're going to call, quote, a computer. Yeah.
I think that's a good point, Harry. I think one of the interesting things I think is going to happen in the future is hardware.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, you know, I need a big screen. I need a keyboard. I use a mouse quite a lot. But cell phones are getting much more powerful. But I can't deal with a little keyboard, and I can't really deal with a little screen. So, yeah. You know, maybe voice control, voice typing, and that kind of thing would be one way to do it. But maybe we're going to see the thing directly connected to our brains at some point, and we can just think things, and the cell phone will do it for us.
Well,
but the other question is, what's going to happen to the display? How are you going to get a big display? Some kind of holographic projection?
Yeah.
I mean, I can see something like that's going to happen. You're going to have a small computing device that you can tote around, but it's going to be easy to do input, and somehow there's going to be a decent-sized output device.
Well, your input is probably going to be your voice. I mean,
yeah. It's interesting, smart glasses. Like, just talking about the smart glasses and things like that, there is an interface now. I don't know if it works with all of the AR, augmented reality glasses, but you can actually plug it in such that you can have, say, Windows File Explorer floating in the air in front of you, and you can actually reach out and grab files and move them and things like that. It's available now, apparently.
Tom Cruise does it all the time.
Yeah. I don't know how effective this really is, but it is there right now, apparently.
Yeah.
If I could jump in further to Alan's point about mobile devices being so powerful, there is a product now. It's called the Next Dock, and it's essentially like a laptop with a keyboard and a screen, but you just plop your mobile phone into it and as a CPU, and it becomes a laptop. So you have a full-size keyboard and a laptop-size screen, and your device is powering this laptop. And when you're done using this thing, you just pull your phone out, stick it in your pocket or wherever you stick it, and carry on with your day.
I like the question in the chat from Glenn. You know, do AI-enabled smartphones or laptops, i.e. devices with onboard AI chips, provide useful, worthwhile features for the average user yet? And maybe the yet is the key point in all of that. I actually bought a laptop. It's an Asus, and it has an AI-capable processor on it that does its 40 trillion operations per second, whatever is needed. There's virtually nothing that actually takes advantage of that at this point in time. I think I probably paid way too much for it just to get that and see what it would do for me, because it's doing really very, very little. There are a couple of Windows features that depend on you having an AI-capable, or what is it they call it?
NPU?
Yeah, an NPU, but it's a class of PCs, they say, that Microsoft has dubbed that are the AI-capable PCs. And there are a few features like recall that apparently only work if you have such a PC. But outside of that, I think you're buying into future thoughts.
They already have, they've had for several years on the Quest 3D goggles headset. They've already had kind of virtual offices with, you can show multiple screens, and they're very high resolution, but you can also move closer if you want to see things up close. But they already have had that with kind of really, really virtual offices for a number of years now. I think the only thing that's kind of stopping it is it being awkward having a headset that's a little heavy to carry around all the time.
but they've had it. It exists now.
Okay, there's another question in the chat. What steps should you take if your handheld is lost or stolen? What should you do to prepare in advance for this catastrophe?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody lost a smell cell phone?
Well, I mean, on your phones, your Android or your iPhones, there should be something there that allows you to track your device.
The ability to do remote wipe is important, so that if you do lose it, that as long as that thing appears on the internet at some point, then it can be remotely wiped, so anything sensitive on it is gone.
You might have complained bitterly if I go in another room, so I'm not likely to lose it.
Google Find My Device. There is a function like that on both iOS and I'm sure Pixel phones, but probably most Android phones, that allow you to connect up with Google and say, I lost my phone. Where is it? On a website. And the moment it turns on, you turn that on, if your phone's on, you'll be able to locate it on the map as to where it is. So that's been solved already, but you have to look it up, and I think you may have to turn it on, although usually it prompts for it when you set up a device.
I think in terms of preparing for loss, making sure that you have a password on your device, so that if you do lose it, you don't have somebody easily be able to access the information on it. That would certainly be critical. So a good password.
And have it backed up into the cloud onto a stick.
Yeah, backed up so that, if you do lose it, you don't lose any of the important data that's on it, yeah?
So how would you actually back it up, or what would you back up?
Well, the iPhone handles that in iCloud,
yeah.
So if you did lose your phone or whatever, let's say you reset the thing, you can always recover from iCloud.
And what about Android? I would have to back up individual folders.
You'll have to talk to the Android expert.
Well, I mean, I think, I would be backing up my contacts. I'd make sure I had copies of photos if I wanted photos.
Do they not
have anything else on my phone that I really, really need? It's just a.
Do they not have any automatic backups on Android? I think Android does have an automatic backup. You'd have to check that.
I'm pretty sure it does. I've used it before when I switched phones. When an early phone, I fell and dropped while I was biking, and it was not usable at all. And I was just able to sign in, get a new phone, and then sign in and get back almost everything. Well, a few of the settings in some of the apps were not what I had set. But aside from that, it was all back to the way it was, that I didn't detect any difference other than those minor settings.
Well, there isn't even a SIM card in it. Because when mine fell on the bottom of the tub, and I couldn't even turn it on. And I went and got a new phone, and he just transferred all my contacts, everything off my phone, onto the new phone. The only thing I lost was my photos, because I didn't have a SIM card in it. They were actually stored on the phone.
SIM cards don't store photos. It's
I meant SD card.
I'm surprised you couldn't take out the micro SD card and take it to dry it out and so on. I think it's fairly waterproof.
No, I didn't have one in it. That's what I'm saying.
Question. I'm still looking for an easy way to group the elements that get added to the various contextual menus, the right click menus. when you install software. For instance, I'd like to group the security entries scan with Verisoft Malware Hunter and scan with Bitdefender. Right now, those two entries are separated by a series of other randomly located entries. Does anybody know how to do that? How to group elements in right-click menus?
Yeah, there's a few utilities that'll do it. Easy Context Menu Hack is one of them. Let's see one. Open Shell. I know that one's got it.
Hey, Steve. That question is mine. I think that those software only manage Windows native entries. I'm not sure, but I think I've tried a couple of those, and that's all they do. They don't do third-party entries like the other software. But
you can add whatever program you want into the context menus.
Okay, can you order them? Can you make them? Can you group them? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Let's see. Find that thing. Make sure I know what it's called. Yeah, that's called Easy Context Menu.
And Tom's put the URL in the chat.
Yeah, I saw that. Thanks. Okay, I'll check it out. Thanks.
Yeah, it allows you to rearrange things and put them in whatever heading, category, order you want.
Okay, for the different context menu, because if you right-click on a PDF, you get a different context menu than if you click on a JPEG, for instance. Do you know if it's...
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
You should do.
Yeah, okay. Okay. I'll check it out. Thanks. Also, to come back to Windows 10, moving on to Windows 11, has anybody tried connecting? Because some motherboards have TPM connectors on them, and there's nothing on those TPM connectors. And I read that you could buy a board, a small board, for $20, $10, $15 that you could connect there and upgrade easily to Windows 11.
And there are two minor machines. You just got to make sure you get the right one. If it's an Asus or Asus ROG, they're different. And they're real cheap. You order them out of China. They're like basically $4, $5. I ordered two, one for each machine. And it works perfect.
And you could upgrade to Windows 11 with that?
Yep.
If it meets the CPU requirements as well, huh?
Or you can take Harvey's approach. He just uses the things that bypass the requirement for those hardware elements.
Yeah, but then when you come to the next Windows update, you got to do that all over again.
Yeah,
welcome to the computer life.
Yeah.
Okay, a question here. I'm considering moving some of my PCs to Linux. Yay! When ESU runs out in October because they don't qualify for Windows 11. What full disk backup software would you recommend that's similar to Acronis or Easus to do backup? Chris, you're the backup guru.
Well, I that's fine on the PC side, on the Windows side, but I have no clue when it comes to you moving over to Linux. So you're the one with all of the answers on that there, Alan.
Yeah, well, what I use is is Foxconn. Foxconn is a live USB, essentially, a live drive anyway. I use a live USB, and you just boot into the USB and it brings up a Linux desktop. Foxconn is on the desktop as an application. You run that, and you can do full disk backups, individual partitions. You can do restores. It works really well. It's really easy, nice user interface, and it's not really Windows and it's not really Linux because it's a bootable USB. it is actually Linux-based, but that doesn't really matter from that standpoint.
I presume, though, that there is some, like, I mean, one of the things that I really like about the fact that, you know, in Windows, my backup program, it can run at 1 o'clock in the morning, and it can just do its magic. I presume that there's some Linux backup programs that are likewise capable, that once you get into Linux, then you could set this up so that it does scheduled backups and so forth.
I'm sure you're right. I don't do scheduled backups, okay. So I don't care.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a shame Macrium doesn't have a Linux version.
Well, Macrium's not free anymore either, so.
Yeah, so just to answer a little bit more on that, I mean, there's two aspects to the backup of if you're moving to Linux. So one is that I think you want to have a good backup before you actually convert over, and then the other is backing up after you've gotten there. As long as you're willing to do it as an offline backup, you could use Foxclone backup, and it'll back up your current Windows installation so that if you have to recover it because something goes wrong, then you'd be able to use the bootable flash drive with Foxclone on it to recover your Windows configuration. And then once you're in Linux, you could use it there as well, as long as you don't mind being offline to do it.
I have a question. if you're going to, for example, move all your pictures and documents from Windows to Linux, do any of the backup solutions for Windows also have a way of accessing those same files in Linux?
Well,
Linux can read Windows drive, so you know you don't really need to move anything. I dual boot, so I have three partitions essentially: for the Windows partition, a Linux partition, and the data partition. And Linux and Windows both use exactly the same files on the data partition. Now, if you're coming from a Windows machine and moving everything to Linux, you would bring the folders over from Windows and drop them onto Linux. They're just files, JPEGs and that kind of stuff, PDFs. They just sit on the Linux drive and you can access them from Linux. Okay, talking about moving computers and stuff, one other question here. I need to replace my Windows 10 computer. I wonder why. Should I buy a laptop, a desktop, a mini computer, or a Chromebook?
Depends on what you do with it.
Well, I'm dual user. What do I do with it? Email, browsing, write a few Word documents, read PDF files.
Anything else? Will do that too.
A Chromebook is cheap enough and works for any kind of internet stuff, and I think it keeps local documents as well. You really need a fancier computer if you're doing other stuff like you want it to go really fast, or you're playing games, or you're editing videos. That's when you really need a powerful beast.
Don't Chromebooks have a shelf life, though?
Yeah, they have had a shelf life, but there's a version of the Chromebook that you can load onto Windows computers, and it is being updated, and I believe you can load those onto Chromebooks as well, although I could be wrong about that.
That Flex you're talking about?
That's right.
And in essence, a Windows computer has a shelf life as well, because while Microsoft will try to force on you, might be longer than the shelf life of a Chromebook, but essentially that's what Microsoft did when they said, oh, if you're older than an 8th gen core processor, you can't have Windows 11, so you're stuck with something that is no longer supported. And I think that's the same thing with the Chromebook. It's not going to stop functioning, right? But it's just not going to be supported any longer. So I've often maintained that, you know, we shouldn't run computers to run an operating system. We run computers so we can run the programs that run on the operating system. Mm-hmm. So I think if you find the least expensive, capable platform that will run the applications that you want to run, that's what you should aim for.
Yeah, Windows machines have a lifetime, but they never used to. That's the problem. Windows 10
that's
is the
true.
First time it's kind of gone away.
Yeah, that's true.
You can still run XP on your current Intel or AMD. One of the reasons to opt for a laptop is that it has a battery, so it has its own built-in UPS. So if the power goes out, you're not going to either lose the current document or photo you're editing, and you won't have your hard drives or your SSDs kind of messed up while they're being written. So that's one reason to have a laptop. Another reason is to have a laptop is if you're traveling, if you go places, if you need to have it in school or at another workplace, or you want to carry your information along with you, or you're going on vacation. That's one of the reasons to have a laptop, and it's not, the increment is not that much anymore. The only people who really need desktops are people, are gamers who are putting in water cooling and big graphics cards and stuff like that. But you can get some small desktops. I mean, I have one hanging behind one of my monitor that I'm using for OpenSense. That'll run very just as easily for a standard ordinary cloud use. But there are reasons for having laptops and reasons for having desktops. You can get these small desktop computers for $100 or $200, but often laptops are a little bit more, and you get a monitor with it and a UPS.
Yeah, Jeff threw something into the chat. Alan, can you not just run the backup in Linux on a scheduled basis using cron? No, you can't, because it has to run from a flash drive. So you have to boot the computer to the flash drive and then run the backup. So it doesn't have an app that can run from within a running Linux. And Kai has a comment there. Frame laptops are upgradable, but $3 signs, I think you might have to add a couple of dollar signs to that. I've heard really good things about it, and certainly, yeah, either you can upgrade just about any component on it, you know, but they are quite expensive. I know Linux Sebastian of Linux Tech Tops, Tech, whatever his channel is, he invested heavily in Frame, and I think he came to regret it. They're not as popular as they had hoped they were going to be.
Most laptops, I mean, you have to look into the manual. You can update the RAM and the storage, and so you can get up to 4 terabytes of SSD that'll fit into an M2 slot. And for RAM, most of them will take 64 gigabytes. So those are that's kind of updating you can do. And
Sabrin,
I know in the past,
Sabrin
I updated
does have an 8-terabyte one.
Pardon me?
Sabrin does make an 8-terabyte SSD.
Oh, maybe. I haven't. No. Yeah, but pricey. It costs more than the laptop.
More than your car.
If you look into it and check, you can update. Like, for example, my current laptop has room for 2 M2 slots. So one I have the original OS on, and the other is a 4-terabyte SSD. So you can update those and increase the sizes. I was going to say that in the past, I've actually upgraded the CPU in a laptop because I think it was one of my ThinkPads 701. And because the CPUs were in a, they could be interchanged. Like on desktops, in fact, you can interchange CPUs, but on laptops, they're almost always soldered in these days.
Yeah, the framework laptops, they allowed you to upgrade just about anything. If you didn't like your flavor of USB ports, you could swap them out for something else, things like that. If you go to frame.work, it shows you all of the different things that you can upgrade on it. But yeah, they are pretty expensive.
Well, there's some information in the chat here. Tim's asking if mini PCs are better than desktops or laptops. Stu is saying that mini PCs are basically a small desktop with a laptop processor. Harvey says it depends on your needs, and a couple of clients have used B-Link successfully. So, Tom, what were you talking about there that's running your behind your monitor? That is a mini PC?
That is a mini PC, and it came because it's meant for this. It came with four 2.5 gigabit Ethernet ports, and it has two or three USB ports and an HDMI port, and I don't know what else, but it's on the back of my monitor. and it cost me, I bought it, I think, from Newegg in Calgary, and it cost me, I think, about $180 because it was on sale. And it has a 5105 processor with four cores. So, yeah, most of those use a laptop processor because they're easy on watts, and so you can power them quite easily, and you don't want too much heat back there anyway in a little bit, in a little box.
Yeah, so you basically get a small form factor package with lots of ports generally, so lots of connectivity, and a decent processor. So if your processing needs are not huge, that's actually probably a pretty good option.
The mini PC does have a lot of horsepower on them. I mean, you can get i7s, or what I prefer is the Ryzen 7. And they come with 32 gigs of memory, 1 terabyte SSD, and you've got everything you really need. Lots of ports, as Tom says. You can hook up a couple of monitors very easily.
Yeah, I've seen some people hook up a full-size NVIDIA graphics card to it that's bigger than the unit itself. Like, what's the point?
I know.
There was
money to burn.
In my how to buy a PC presentation, just for yucks as much as anything else, I have in there the Asus has the world's first Copilot Plus NUC that came out last year. You can get up to Intel Core Ultra 7, 165H, 16 cores, 22 threads, up to 96 gigabytes of RAM, two M.2 mm-hmm. slots with up to 6 terabytes of solid state, dual HDMI, Wi-Fi 7, 2.5 gigabit Ethernet, Bluetooth 5.4, two USB 4 Type-Cs with Thunderbolt, four USB 3.2 Type-As, speaker and microphone for about $3,000.
Very cool. Yeah, they're very cool running.
If you want to run AI locally, the only thing that's really affordable and possible is to get one of the MacBooks M series with at least 64 gigabytes of memory. And because the reason for that is that the RAM is accessible by all the GPUs. And so that's what you need for running a large model.
Serge Eric has raised his hand, so go ahead, Serge.
It's just about the mini PCs there. I owned one for some time, and the fan on this thing was like an airplane. So just make sure that you try to connect it before you buy it, if you can do that. Make sure that the sound level is not too high.
Good point. I think Karen has an interesting question in the chat, which I think anybody who's trying to keep up with tech might want to know what the fellow geeks on the call tonight think about this. So much activity in the computing world on so many topics. How do you stay up to date? Who do you regularly follow, and what do you regularly read and monitor?
Okay, who wants to go first?
A lot of times I listen to Chris. He has a lot of good ideas.
Oh, foolish, man. Foolish.
No, there's a variety of sources of information, and it's spread quite widely. And you get to understand and know where you can pick up the information that is useful to yourself. Like, you know, somebody else would be looking for different subjects. Anyway, you have to look and find what is suitable for yourself.
Ask Leo is a good one. I use that one quite a lot.
Yeah.
The only regular source that I go to is Security Now on the Twit network, which is I listen to the podcast. It's called Security Now. The guy who does it runs GRC.com, and he's the one that created the disk recovery thing called, I think, Spinrite. That's the only one I regularly follow. But yeah. I do get notices of things. But, I mean, I can't afford the newest hardware anyway. So however excited I might be, it was never as exciting as when PC World was 500 pages.
And when you want your jaw to drop on the floor, you watch Dave Plummer.
Dave Plummer's entertaining.
Yeah. He has all the historical stuff.
Yeah, did you see the one where he was trying to explain how you could run AI on an old computer that had never even heard of the internet or anything else, and you could see the lights flashing on the thing, and he actually got AI to run on this thing that was incredible, and then he explained how it did it, and yeah, he was trying to show how simple it was, but he made it so complex that.
Alan, who do you follow?
Well, I used to read PC Magazine, PC World, and Maximum PC at the Ottawa Library. That was online for quite a while. Probably still there. They used to send me an email when there was a new issue, but they stopped doing that. So I haven't been following it quite so frequently these days. I follow PC Magazine and PC World online, but I find these days it's like 90% adverts rather than actual articles. So I don't find that terribly useful. On the Linux world, let me see, what do I use on Linux? Me up here, maybe. I look at OMG Ubuntu. That's actually quite, he's pretty good in terms of up to date information on Linux. Ask Ubuntu has a whole bunch of questions. That's a forum. And the other one I like is Explaining Computers. It's very oriented to Linux, single board computers, and some other stuff. And Gary explains, Gary Sims from Android Authority, he used to be, he has good videos on stuff too. So those are kind of the things I spend most of my time looking at.
I used to follow Windows Weekly. On a fairly regular basis. It's hosted by Paul Thurrott, who has written about Windows and Microsoft for probably over 50 years now. And Leo Laporte, who is the chief twit at twit.com. And it's interesting if you are interested in what's going on at Microsoft and their latest moves on products and you know, even down to, you know, they talk about when they do the layoffs and reorgs within the company and their profit reporting and things like that. So it's very, very focused on Windows and Microsoft in particular.
What
so
was
if you're
the
interested
the,
in that.
What was the name of the series that Leo Laporte did like 20 years ago?
I don't know. I've only followed what he's been doing since.
Lab with Leo. That's what it was. That was very good.
He used to be a Canadian broadcaster in Toronto.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the Lab with Leo moved to BC.
I find too, if you can find a some email newsletter, can be really handy if you find one that has some interesting information that interests you. It can be really nice to get that idea of that once a week newsletter that allows you to peruse it quickly and then delve deeply into particular stories within that newsletter that pique your interest. You can go dive into that a little bit more. So I follow a number of newsletters, and I drop them just as quickly as my interest wanes. I'm all over the map when it comes to trying to follow things, though. So I'm not one to, say, oh, follow this person or this person, because, my interests come and go on that. So what I do to keep up to date on things changes over time as well.
The Ottawa newsletter is amazing. That's the one I follow.
Yeah, Bridget does a pretty good job of it.
Yeah. Mal has a question. What advantages, disadvantages in using docking stations versus hubs? Who out there has any idea about what are the differences between docking stations and hubs? Harvey, do you have experience with that?
Well, a docking station has a number of ports that you can plug into. I mean, you're talking about video, USB, HDMI, all different kinds of ports that you can.
Yeah, it's like a KVM switch.
That too. If you're looking at a hub, that's kind of a generic plug-in. I only use a hub for maybe Ethernet. There might be four cables distributed to four machines. The main Ethernet cable would be going into the modem, something like that.
And plugging a lot of hard drives into a hub.
Yeah, you could. Yeah.
The other kind of hub you can get is a USB hub, where you're basically plugging one USB into your computer, but it's giving you 4, 6, 8 additional USB ports to plug into.
Yeah, Cal is it's fading out with his virtual background, but he's holding up a box with something there.
Or you can use a switch, they call it.
Yeah,
docking station normally means you bring along your laptop and you plug it into the dock, and that the dock is connected to a real keyboard, a real mouse, and a real display. So you're getting
It's also connected to the bus of your computer. Instead of USB, it's connected directly to the bus of your computer on a real docking station. Like your IBM laptops, it's actually right on your bus, which is way faster than the USB.
The USB hub connects to the bus as well.
I mean, a simple hub just has some USB connections. But a docking station is just a big hub that has a variety of connections to it. Usually has Ethernet, some USBs, and may has SD cards or micro SD cards. It might have HDMI. It might have other display card. Display cards, that was called DisplayLink, and other things. So it depends on what you need to connect to and how many of them you need to connect to. So I wouldn't make a distinction really between them unless you're just talking about a plain old USB sub.
Yeah, good point.
Does anybody have any experience with Flex? One of the questions here is, does the Chromebook OS Flex have unlimited security updates? Are they always available cost-free?
Tech for Seniors is the best place to ask that one. They have a Monday show at 11:30 on Monday morning.
I think it's interesting. Tom threw into the chat that, and this goes back to keeping up on tech news, I guess. If you subscribe to Perplexity Pro, You can set up scheduled tasks that give you news you want. And I guess even if you don't pay for Perplexity Pro, or even if you don't get it for free, asking AI for, you know, what is a good source of tech news on a variety of different topics could probably point you in a couple of interesting ways that, you know, you could go check them out and see if you agree with the AI. And if you do, then you use whatever facilities they have to either send it to you by email or RSS feed or whatever. But it might be able to point to some interesting sources for you.
So one of the questions here is, I hear that memory is really expensive right now. How can I limit the cost for RAM and an SSD in my new machine?
Take up a new hobby.
Or take it out of your old machine and put it into the new one.
I was thinking one of the things you can do there is just not buy so much RAM in the computer. Right now, if it's really expensive, just go with some like 4 gigabytes. It'll probably get you, unless you've got really high-end requirements. As Joe user, 4 gigabytes will probably get you where you need to be. And then when RAM comes cheaper, just make sure that you've got slots available that you can plug more RAM into, and then you just add more RAM later on when it's cheaper.
You wouldn't want to run Windows 11 on 4 gigs.
No.
Minimum 8.
Well, some of us can't run Windows 11, so we don't know that.
But that is a good case in point, I guess, is the idea that, limiting. Look, if you're buying new computers now, it used to be, like less than a year ago probably, that it was quite standard to get a computer with 16 gigs of RAM. It wasn't really hard. Now it looks like they're all 8 gigs. RAM, because rather than charging an extra $1,000 for the computer or something like that, they're keeping the price low by limiting the amount of RAM.
When I bought my Alienware computer about, I guess, 2 to 3 years ago, it came with, I think, 8 gigabytes, and I upgraded it to 64 gigabytes, which cost me a munificent $132 total for 64. I checked the price recently, and it was $882, and it wasn't available.
So presumably you could do the same thing with an SSD, although it's not quite as easy. You could buy a smaller SSD, and then later on take that out, put a bigger one in, and use the smaller one in an external USB case, and you've got an external USB drive which is an SSD.
Yep. SSDs are expensive too now. I upgraded my NAS 2 years ago. I think it was about $300. It's now $800 for the same product.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane.
You're better off just buying a refurb computer because the prices are just, well, David, he just built one not that long ago, and it's over double now. For what you paid.
Amazing.
And they're not going to be coming down either.
Refurb or not, it may be cheaper to buy a used computer off of a Facebook Marketplace or someplace that has the memory that you like and the speeds that you like. You do have to be careful, though. Things are upgradable. M.2 is fairly upgradable. There's no worries there now, at least. But for RAM, they come in different flavors for your laptop, depending on how old your laptop is. DDR4, the latest is DDR5, I think, and I think DDR6 is just coming in.
You can get DDR6 as well.
Just make sure they are not plug compatible. So just be careful if you're going to buy any upgrades that they will work in your computer.
Go on a visit to the Trailing Edge on Queensview Drive. They have a lot of options there. I had one client. She purchased a open box laptop, and it's a horror story because you don't get the full warranty. You have to be aware that if you're buying an open box, whatever the date is when it was made, that's the remainder of the warranty. You might only get 4 months. So be careful.
That's true.
Going back to a previous question about following tech and keeping up to date, Stu put into the chat, if you're on mobile or you're interested in mobile, mobilesyrup.com and iPhoneinCanada.ca are sites that have a lot of information. So if you're looking to keep up to date on phones in Canada, there's two sites you might want to check out.
So another question on the new machines. When I get my new machine, do I need to buy a Microsoft 365 subscription?
No, you get LibreOffice.
Yeah. I knew somebody would come up with that pretty quick.
Microsoft is like a vacuum picking up your money. So
yeah. If you don't have really heavy duty needs of transferring documents between you and somebody else who is using the Microsoft Office suite, I agree with that. I mean, I'm a cheap SOB, and so I don't think you should spend any more money than you have to. And if your needs are fairly modest, you don't do a lot of transferring of documents where you need absolute fidelity as you transfer them back and forth, going with LibreOffice is a really good choice.
I think regarding Microsoft Office, I think the latest version, I think Office 365, includes something like 100 gigabytes of storage. So if you have a whole bunch of photos, you could store it in there. And I think it's only like $6 or $7 a month.
I think. With Microsoft Office 365, I think your storage is 1 terabyte that they need. Yeah.
1 terabyte per user. So if you buy the family pack is actually a good deal. If you have six people who are interested, they don't have to be in families, so there's absolutely no requirement that you have any relationship with these other people at all. But I think it's about, I forget exactly, I think it was about 160 Canadian per year, where if you have six people and each of them gets a terabyte of storage, and each person can install it on, I think, up to 5 devices. So, you know, it can be a good deal. But certainly if you have just one or two computers, Microsoft Office or, you know, Microsoft 365 is not a very cheap option for you. So, yeah.
Serge Eric has raised his hand. Go ahead, Serge.
Yes, I am... I have some pretty complex tables that do not transfer well from Microsoft Office to LibreOffice. I have to stick to Microsoft Office for this reason.
But you can always run it online, and you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, the online is a little bit brain dead, though, so it's not the full feature set of that you get with standalone apps. It's not bad for light use, but if you're doing light use, I would say, yeah, just go LibreOffice.
You could, if you want to transfer between Word and LibreOffice, you might want to try saving your files in Microsoft as RTF format, that's revisable text format, and see if they look okay to you. If they look okay to you, then I think you can import them into LibreOffice, and they'll look okay there, too. I mean, the main problem is formatting rather than most other things.
I was going to say, Serge Eric makes a very good point. If you have extremely complex documents, you're best to load them in whatever program created them in the first place.
Yeah. The biggest thing I find problematic when it comes to transferring documents back and forth between multiple people is the recipient typically doesn't even realize that they're not getting the fidelity that it was created in. So a good case in point was that I use in my font for my typography presentation is that if you create this lovely poster for some purpose and you use some fancy font that you've got on your computer, and then it looks really nice, you send it off to somebody else to print out 500 copies to be posted everywhere, they bring it up on their computer, they have no clue that you used a different font. They'll get a font substitute happen. And so they might get a very plain, like Calibri or something like that, whereas you use a nice script. They won't realize it. They'll print out these 500 copies, and they don't know that the fidelity was not held on there. And such is the life with anything that you do between multiple computers, if you're going between LibreOffice and Microsoft Office, is that the person who's getting the document doesn't even realize.
If you're going to just print it out and send it as a PDF,
and
you can include all the fonts with it.
I agree, but then there are cases where they'll send it over as a Microsoft Office document saying, "Oh, please drop in your paragraph of information," or things like that. Not so easy if you've got a PDF file. So there is a need that you can have where editing files across the board like that. Alan and I are running into that right now, where he's trying to give up Microsoft Office and Windows totally, and I'm still there using Microsoft PowerPoint for our Q&A sessions, and we have files that go back and forth between us. And we've been bitten a couple of times on font choices where I used the font that he didn't have on his computer, and it came up totally wrong. And I'm sure that there'd be other fidelity issues if I send him a PowerPoint file and he brings it up in LibreOffice, and he will not realize that it's been changed somehow.
You can always use Google Docs.
And for PDFs, you can open those in Word and edit them, and that's one way around that.
Harvey, have you ever actually tried to edit the text in a PDF file? I found it to be a horror story.
And there's no problem. Yeah.
I do it all the time in Acrobat.
Yeah, I've had a horror story the way it comes up in some PDF editors.
I know exactly what you're talking about, Crystal, because we do a memorial golf tournament, and Lynn tried to do nice fancy font, and then when they printed the brochure, it didn't show.
Yeah.
So it's like now you know what, just keep it simple.
Yeah, it's
print place would have all these fonts, but they didn't. No, they didn't.
Well, there's probably 100,000 fonts out there, right? So that's the problem is that, if you use that. Let me just actually bring up, I'm going to just show an example. I'm going to just share. And this is an example in my presentation. So what you see in the top left is where I used a special font, and it was this Cotton Candies that I downloaded from a free font site. And then I bring it up on a document or on a computer that didn't have that font installed. And so this is both with the same version of Microsoft Word, but just that font change. And again, the person who would bring that up, they would not necessarily realize that this had a special font used, and they might, just go on assuming that that was the way it looked on the originator's computer as well. So issues like that can really come back to bite you when you're trying to go between computers, between operating systems. Well, not so much your operating system, but certainly between the applications. Big problems.
Yeah, initially they all thought that PDFs were secure. I can remember, in the office, so I said to them, "Well, you send me your most secure PDF, and I'll show you just how secure it is." After that, they realized not quite as secure as they thought they were.
Timothy mentions that don't forget that Microsoft has viewers to read some of their product output only. And Timothy, do you know if they've kept up to date on that? Because I know at one point they only had it for some older versions of their products, and they didn't have them for the latest, greatest of Office 365 or whatever. Timothy, do you know if they actually kept that up?
No, I've got some old viewers, plus my Office 2013 still on my computers, so I don't know if they kept up or not.
Yeah.
They might have, for all I know. I just haven't checked because I haven't really done much with the documents anymore.
Okay.
I just keep trying to read my old documents. So that's about it.
Yeah. Karen asks, what are my favorite sites for free fonts? There's two that I will go to. For generally speaking, high-quality fonts, if you go to Google Fonts, they have over 1,000 fonts that are all free. And if you're a web designer, one of the nice things about using fonts from there is you can actually embed the code so that anybody going to your website will get the actual font that you chose as opposed to doing any sort of font substitute. The other site that I've done, I've gotten quite a few fonts from is dafont.com, so dafont.com, and they have probably about 30,000 fonts available. Some are not free, but there's an awful lot that aren't free, that are free, and there's mixed quality on that. So I've come across a lot of fonts that are very poor quality, but I've come across a lot on there that I think are stellar quality fonts that are available free of charge. And one of the nice things about dafont.com is when you go onto the main page, you can actually filter. So you can say, oh, okay, I want a serif versus a sans serif, or I want a script font, and I only want free fonts. And, you can go in and you can filter down so that it will come up with the, you know, down to the 100 that meet your criteria, and then you can page through them. So I find dafont.com is quite a good site. But for consistently good quality fonts, Google Fonts is a really good site. Anybody else got any other ideas of sites for fonts?
Just a note, I think in a lot of programs, you can include the fonts along with the document and include the entire font or choose just the characters you used. I think you can do that in Word.
LibreOffice will allow you to do it too. Yeah, no, you can. And LibreOffice will allow you to embed fonts as well, if the font allows it. And I came across one example, which was, I thought, really bizarre, for a font that was listed as free for personal use, but it didn't allow embedding. And I thought, why would you do that? And I guess it was the fact that it was free for personal use as opposed to totally free, that they actually tagged it so that you couldn't embed it in Word or LibreOffice. But if they are free fonts, usually you can embed them in the document, and then when the person opens it, they will get the full fidelity of the font.
So, Jerit, has your hand up again? Go ahead.
Yeah, to come back to LibreOffice, I have tried OpenOffice with one of my table, and it looks much better in OpenOffice than it does in LibreOffice, and OpenOffice is free as well.
Okay, well, we've hit 9 o'clock, Chris, so I think we should probably call it quits. Thanks to all the geeks for answering the questions, and thanks to all the participants for asking the questions.
And
if you've got more questions, we can ask them next week at Q&A.
Thanks very much for participating, folks, and especially people who chimed in with their own ideas throughout it all. This is the first time we've actually tried this. I think it was a success, and so we'll maybe consider doing it again in the future. But until then, as Alan says, we've got Q&A every other Wednesday night. Hope to see you all at Q&A next week.